Hey everyone, welcome to the first episode of You Belong in AI. I'm your host, Arden Subramanian, and today we'll be interviewing Professor Carrie Notchenberg. Carrie Notchenberg is a software engineer, published author, rock climber, and computer science professor. Carrie works at Lyft Level 5 Autonomy with a team of brilliant engineers and scientists designing and building autonomous vehicles, also known as self-driving cars. He holds 100 plus United States patents relating to his work in the software field. Carrie also recently published his first novel, a techno thriller entitled The Florentine Deception with Open Road. Carrie's debut novel is now available in paperback, audiobook, on Audible and iTunes, and ebook formats. Carrie's been rock climbing in the Santa Monica Mountains for the past 20 plus years and enjoys sport climbing and top roping at the 511 and 512 level. You'll often find him out at the Planet of the Apes wall in Malibu Creek State Park. Carrie is an adjunct professor of computer science at UCLA, where he teaches CS32, data structures and algorithms, C++, and object-oriented programming once per year. Carrie holds a bachelor's and master's degree in computer science from UCLA. So quickly, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background, you know, what inspired you to pursue CS? And talk about your experience majoring in CS at UCLA.
Sure. So when I was 11 years old, my father bought me my first computer, which was a $50 computer. It was a couple years old, a TI-99/4A. He didn't think I was going to get into it, and I didn't think I would either. And I started programming it, you know, nights and weekends. And it was something that I actually was pretty good at after a while. I sort of spent a lot of time on it. I could do it on my own. Nobody was telling me how fast to go or that I had to learn it by a certain time. And so it was one of the few things I was actually good at as a kid. And by the time I was in high school, I was programming all the time. I really enjoyed it. It was something I was good at. People recognized me for it. And I thought, well, I got to go do this in college because it's something I really enjoy. It's one thing I found in life that I'm good at. And so it was, there's no question when I went to school that's what I was going to do. What was my experience majoring in computer science at UCLA? It was a different time back then. It was a program where there wasn't all the support networks we have now. There weren't all the student organizations that are helping other students that we have now. So it was really a much more nascent program, smaller. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed a lot of my classes. I thought they were really interesting. I thought a lot of them were very theoretical, and I would probably never use most of what I learned, and that's been true. I've never used about 90% of what I learned. But actually, I think that especially in this new job, I'm starting to use a lot of the things that I never used before. So maybe in retrospect, it was good.
That's really awesome to hear. And I'm really glad. It's really nice to hear too, that you started from such a young age with, you know, a computer that your dad got you, and that passion really carried through through college and then to your current job. So just the next question I'm going to ask is, so when you were a student at UCLA, you said that there weren't all these support structures. But did UCLA's CS community suffer from a lack of representation, diverse backgrounds, experiences, any minority groups, especially you can bring into this answer the context that you were a student at UCLA in the 90s?
It was a different time back then. It was a program where there wasn't all the support networks we have now. There weren't all the student organizations that are helping other students that we have now. So it was really a much more nascent program, smaller. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed a lot of my classes. I thought they were really interesting. I thought a lot of them were very theoretical, and I would probably never use most of what I learned. And that's been true. I've never used about 90% of what I learned. But actually, I think that especially in this new job, I'm starting to use a lot of the things that I never used before. So maybe in retrospect, it was good.
That's really interesting to hear. I had no idea that the percentage of women in the CS department actually dropped since the 90s. You'd usually think it's like the other way around.
Yeah, I think in the past there's actually a higher representation, and it's gotten lower. It might be going up again, but there was definitely, I think at some point it was even higher.
This is talking more about your personal experience. Did you think it was very difficult to be open as a student in the 90s? And if you could tie that into why you think representation is important, especially in CS and AI. Do you think it's a lot easier to be open now if you identify as queer?
Okay, well, that's the elephant in the room. So I'm gay. And when I was at school at UCLA, I was not out. I didn't feel comfortable being out. There was definitely much more of a stigma back then. I didn't date. And maybe in some ways that was actually good for me because I spent a lot more time studying and programming and doing things that were better for my career. I think it's much different now. I know students see me all the time and are totally out and tell me, oh yeah, I'm going to see my girlfriend later. And it might be a woman that, you know, you would never have heard that back in the 90s. So there's definitely a level of acceptance and people just don't care nearly as much anymore. I think they still do probably because parents are from a different generation and probably are still caught up in a different mindset. But it's certainly much different than when I went to school for being a gay person.
And if you could touch really quickly on why you think that, especially with all these underrepresented groups, such as like openly queer people or racial minorities, why you think representation is especially important.
Yeah, you know, I'm someone who doesn't really focus on that aspect of my identity that much. In other words, not something that is super important to me as my identity as a person. And so I do believe that the best outcome is for everybody who wants to be enabled and empowered to do something like to study computer science should have the opportunity to do it. I think if anything, a lot of people focus on sort of recruiting when it's too late and sort of trying to make sure that underrepresented minorities are in our programs, like, you know, when they're graduating high school. And I think that if you want to get more people who are underrepresented into engineering programs, the right thing to do is to start really early in junior high school and grade school and in high school so that people realize it's cool to do this. People can do it. They can be successful in it. And there's lots of opportunity and it can be really interesting and it's cool. So taking a step back and not thinking about sort of gay versus straight or, you know, or queer, just in general, I would say that the more people who especially are passionate about it can go and speak to junior highs and high schools about how great it is to be doing software at this time and in the future and getting people excited that otherwise wouldn't be excited or wouldn't have this, they wouldn't know about this, is the only way to improve representation and improve sort of the diverse population we have, which will make everybody better off, right? The more diverse views we have, the more diverse ways of thinking, the more diverse ideas, the better.
Yeah, it's a really awesome answer. And do you think that, you know, continuing on that idea of improving representation, do you think that, do you have any other ideas for improvements you'd want to see that maybe could either occur within the UCLA CS community or that, in fact, like UCLA CS students could engender outside, like, for example, students visiting high schools and really getting students involved from a younger age?
Yeah, really the latter. I would say that, you know, we have such a great culture of helping others at UCLA, especially in the engineering schools. I hear it's not that way in like the pre-med departments where people are much more competitive, but in engineering, we're very helpful to each other. And I would say that if there are any students here that really want to make a difference, and not just talk about it, it's great to hold an event that celebrates underrepresented people in engineering at UCLA for UCLA students. It's much better to go to a junior high school and give a talk to a bunch of students that otherwise would never be exposed to this, because then you're really going to increase the population of students. As it stands, right now there's a fixed population of, let's say, women that are getting into engineering. And so We can advertise all we want right now, but if you don't increase the pool size, you're not going to get more women in engineering. You're just going to steal them away from USC or Caltech or Stanford or Berkeley. And ultimately that doesn't help, you know, change the demographics. And so I would say, go speak, give talks, do Girls Who Code, you know, go give talks to that. I've done that. That's really great. Just like share your experiences and share the excitement that you have with people who otherwise wouldn't be exposed to this stuff.
I'm going to start kind of transitioning into some of the more technical stuff now. I think this is what a lot of listeners are going to be really interested in, especially with your a new change in position from going from like Chronicle to Lyft. But just talk very generally about like what have you been up to since you graduated from UCLA? You know, you're a professor, you've worked in cybersecurity for a long time, you're at Lyft now. And just how has like workplace culture been at all these different places? What have you liked the most about maybe Chronicle versus Lyft?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I graduated in 1995 with my master's and bachelor's from UCLA. I did the, I don't know what it's called now, it was called Departmental Scholar Program back then, where you do your bachelor's and master's at the same time. That was a great thing, by the way. If you do want to get into a field where there is machine learning, for instance, or or other areas like bioinformatics or proteomics or computational biology, where there's, you know, you really need an advanced degree. If you have like 3.5 or higher GPA, you can just get into the master's program and do that. And it's actually a great, really, really fast way to skip GREs and everything else and get in the field. So I did that. I spent 21 years at Symantec. I went from the most junior, the only intern my first year in 1990, I did 5 years of internship there, to the most senior engineer in the company when I left Symantec. I primarily didn't leave Symantec in the later years, not because I was enjoying it, but because I was afraid that I couldn't, I had lost my edge, because I had it so good there that nobody was asking me to do hard stuff. And so I could do whatever I wanted to. And I thought, well, I've lost all my technical skills. I wasn't programming as much. I was more high level. So fortunately, I was recruited away from Symantec in 2016. I love the time I spent at Symantec, a lot of it. I solved a bunch of hard problems, detected self-mutating viruses and built big data systems and, you know, gave lots of talks, did lots of media interviews. Like, I learned all kinds of interesting skills. I have lots of crazy times there. I have lots of stories from Symantec. It was a different time. You could be silly and inappropriate in ways that you just cannot be now. We got away with a lot more stuff. I have lots of stories from that that I probably can't share here. 2016 Chronicle, which wasn't Chronicle time, Google X recruited me away from Symantec. They wanted to do a cybersecurity moonshot project, and a former Symantec executive, they recruited him to run the project. He was a chief operating officer at Symantec, and so he recruited me, and we, together with a couple of other co-founders, built what is now Chronicle. That was about 3.5 years of work to spin it from a concept, lots of debate, and, you know, trying to figure out what the right thing was, to building a product and making millions of dollars and getting reacquired by Google. We were spun out of Google and reacquired by Google. So that was 3.5 years. And then, I hope this isn't getting too long, but then, you know, near the end of that, I thought, you know, one of the things I really enjoyed while I was at Google X was seeing the self-driving car work. I thought it was fascinating. I thought the problems were really interesting, very complex problems, very, very much like cybersecurity problems in some ways, in that in cybersecurity, there's no right answer. There's like, and you have an adversary that's constantly trying to evolve and change. You know, driving a car, a vehicle in traffic in Los Angeles is like protecting against, you know, hacking attacks in many ways. It's like a very unpredictable thing, and there's no right answer. And so as I met more and more people over lunch, just over dinner, working out, just talking to people who are working on that, I said, this is really interesting. And I sort of had some interest in it before. So one of my former UCLA students, a guy named Devin Dutta, which many of you probably know, went to Lyft Level 5, which is the self-driving car division of Lyft. And I told him that I was looking for something new. And he marched up to the executive vice president of Lyft's autonomous vehicle program and said, you have to hire my professor. And the rest is history. So that's where I am now. It's been about 7-8 weeks now, all virtual except for 4 days, which is not great. And it's not good being virtual, but I'm really loving it. It's very interesting.
It's awesome. And could you tell us a little bit more about what Lyft Level 5 is? Describe some of its projects, maybe. This is like, sure, particularly for listeners who may not be super familiar with autonomous driving and the work Lyft does in AI. And also, please describe like what your current role is in Level 5. What's your favorite part about working at Lyft, and how is the work culture?
Sure. So Lyft Level 5 is the autonomous vehicle division in Lyft. So just like Google has a Waymo, believe it or not, many people don't know it, but Lyft has an autonomous vehicle division. Hundreds and hundreds of people working on everything from the hardware in the cars, you know, mounting the computers in the trunk, to building the software that controls the perception, the, you know, computer vision for the stack and the trajectory planning of the stack. It's a big division. I never realized it. It's big. It's hundreds and hundreds of people. And they are trying to achieve level 4 autonomy, even though the name is level 5. So level 4 autonomy means that you have a car that can drive in well-defined sort of conditions. So let's say sunny conditions in Mountain View, California, as long as the roads aren't wet, would be the conditions that a level 4 vehicle could drive in. A level 5 vehicle can drive anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances, without any assistance at all. So But the aspiration obviously would eventually be to get to level 5. That's going to be a long time, I think. So I work in level 5 in the planning and prediction areas. It's called the autonomy area. Autonomy encompasses planning and prediction, sort of planning what the car is going to do, predicting what other agents are going to do in the surrounding areas. Perception is another area that I work with, although I don't, I'm not working as closely with that team, but they're part of my broader organization, sort of perceiving things using LIDAR, computer vision, radar in the environment. And virtually all the software that we build goes on the car itself and actually drives the car. But there's a big cloud component too. There's a big offline component that does, machine learning, obviously, and other things. And there's an online component that has to run very, very quickly.
Wow, that's crazy. That's a lot of stuff. Do you have any thoughts on how close Lyft is to level 4? Are the cars already kind of operating at that level? Do they have that capability to just drive when the conditions are set?
So that I'm not going to disclose any details on that because I'm not allowed to talk about, but I can tell you that the cars are driving on the roads. At least post-COVID, they were driving on the roads, and I've ridden in the vehicles and had a great time riding in the vehicles, and they're pretty impressive. The thing about achieving level 4 or level 5 is, it's a very difficult problem. There's a long tail of things you have to deal with that, driving a car in the 95th percentile of circumstances is not that difficult. In the bottom 5% where the unthinkable happens, a ball comes flying out from the side of the road, a dog runs out in front of you, a person in a clown outfit comes out, machine learning's never seen that before. These are the kinds of things that are super difficult. And so it's going to be a long way to level 5 and even level 4. I don't think companies have been doing it a long time are even really at level 4 today. But it's a really interesting set of problems to work on.
Awesome. And I'm sure you transition from cybersecurity to AI, obviously there's a lot of overlap there between cybersecurity and these autonomous vehicles. But you obviously, with any new job, you have to pick up new skills, learn to ramp up on the code base, learn any new technologies that are being used. So when you come across these topics that you don't know much about currently, but you want to learn more about, how do you usually approach this? And this question is more tailored for students who are really passionate about deep learning, for example, but it's just very hard for them to go online and see all those Greek letters. It's very intimidating. So how do you usually approach learning new things?
Okay, so a couple of things. So first of all, there's this impression that, not to answer your question, but to say answer something related, that self-driving cars are all driven by machine learning. And that is not the case today. I would say most systems on most self-driving cars use what are called statistical robotics, as opposed to machine learning. And machine learning is generally used in vision and perception systems. So just so people know, if you want to get into autonomous vehicles, you're going to do machine learning in some areas, but not in other areas. It's not a well-established field to drive a car entirely by machine learning. People have tried it, and there's a lot of problems with it. Just so people know. As for your other question, which is a really great question, how do I go about learning new things? I am just as intimidated by sigmas and phis and pies and everything else. Well, I like pie, but cherry pie and chocolate cream pie are my favorite. But these things are all very intimidating to me. And if I see a research paper with lots of formulas in it, my eyes glaze over and I become nervous. What I've found is what's worked for me is I found, especially now that YouTube is around, there's lots of different resources, that I will not assume that I'm stupid just because I can't understand a research paper, which I used to do. I just assume the person who wrote the research paper is not very good at writing in a clear way. And so I just keep looking around on the internet, on YouTube, on Khan Academy, on Udacity, on Coursera, until I find an explanation that works for me, because everybody learns differently and everybody has a different background and a different set of terms and knowledge that they can build on. And when you read that research paper and you're intimidated by that, which I am too, it's not because you're dumb or you don't have the skills. It's that nope, they're not explaining to you in a way that's compatible with your current background and knowledge. That doesn't mean you can't learn the stuff. It just means you have to find other resources to build yourself up. And so when I first learned machine learning, for instance, it took me 6 months. I had a friend explain it to me, a friend from UCLA actually, who now lives in Boston. He explained it from the ground up to me, and I just asked him tons of dumb questions. At least for me, I thought they were dumb, and he was very patient. And it took me 6 months to learn some of that stuff. I think it'd be much faster now with the resources online, but I guess I answered in a very long way, but I guess what I would say is try to accept that certain things are going to be difficult to learn. Try not to get discouraged when you find that the first or second or third or fifth resource you find is unintelligible to you or uses math that you don't know, or it's just like difficult to parse because it's difficult to concentrate. And instead, the internet is so vast now, try to find a resource, even if it takes you an hour or two, that speaks to you in language that you understand, and then learn it, and then find somebody to ask a lot of questions to, whether it's a professor, whether it's another friend or a graduate student. And it might take longer than you would hope. You're not going to learn deep learning in 2 days. It might take you 2 months, or in my case, 6 months, but you can learn it. And if you have persistence and you're willing to go hunting for the right content and you're willing to ask questions and not feel stupid or bad by asking those questions, you can learn this stuff.
That's really great advice. I think a lot of students, when they find these resources online, they just stare at the same unintelligible resource, like you said, and then it's kind of like, it's like a positive feedback loop because you just feel like you're not able to understand it, and then you feel like you're starting to lose confidence. But yeah, I'm sure if you have people you can ask questions to, that's always super helpful.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think that there's a lot, like most people are not great communicators, and most people in a research paper are not communicating to people who are novices. They're communicating to other people who are in the field, who know the terms, who took the graduate exams. And so most of these resources are not appropriate for somebody who just wants to learn for the first time, but there are resources that exist. You just have to hunt for them and you have to be patient.
Yeah, definitely. So now this is in summary of in what ways representation intersects with the work that Lyft does. And this is not necessarily just related to experience at Lyft, but more generally, like, why do you think it's important that all kinds of companies hire diverse workers, hire workers with a lot of representation? How does it affect the products they make? What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I am somebody who advocates for diversity of thought. I don't really care what people look like. I don't care anything about other than how they think and that they can bring diverse viewpoints to the table. And people who come from different backgrounds have different viewpoints, and that is always a good thing. It never hurts to have too many viewpoints as long as you can make a decision. You need to be able to decide eventually, and some people aren't going to be happy and some people are going to be happy. But, you know, some people are colorblind. People who are colorblind are going to bring a great deal to UI design for other people who are not colorblind and can't think about designing a UI that, you know, uses red and green, for instance, to distinguish different things. Some people have, you know, think about things differently. When they read things, they read things in a different way. So having people with diverse viewpoints is always a great thing. I've seen it only add value. And so in my mind, the more diverse workforce we can have, not only is it good for creating diversity and exposing typically traditionally underrepresented people to things that they may not have otherwise been exposed to, but it's good for the product.
And I think in addition to that, like, all these different viewpoints are even further enhanced by the fact that all our backgrounds intersect in so many different ways. Where we grew up, the culture that we grew up with, like, all of that really plays a role in, you know, developing the product, and that makes our product so much more equitable for everyone who's using it. So yeah, I really love that answer. Like, I think it's awesome that you've only seen diversity improve your product positively.
Absolutely. You know, people have different ways of thinking about things. They have different ways of interacting with the world, different ways of problem solving, different interpretations of things. And the more diversity you have, the better idea you can have about whether the UI that you think is great is going to appeal to other people as well and solve their problems, not just the ones that you have in your head.
Yeah, so now we're going to move on to our last two questions, really quickly wrap up this interview. So as a professor, you work with tons of students from, you know, various backgrounds. In what ways do you ensure that all students, regardless of background, regardless of how represented they are within the CS community, have access to avenues to succeed? So you have office hours regularly. You participate in the CS town hall. Are there any other ways, or you can elaborate on those two examples that I brought up?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I do offer to all my students, and I would say, you know, a good 5-10% taking up on it during the quarter, and then even not during the quarter when I teach, is I offer, you know, one-on-one video meetings or in-person meetings when COVID's not around, for people who want to talk about anything. And because people have lots of problems. And if you don't know that, if one of your good friends, if you don't know their problems and they're not a good friend, you don't know them well. And so like people have lots of challenges in life. And so the way I try to make myself available to help people is just to offer my time. And so I schedule meetings regularly with people, or people schedule meetings with me regularly to talk about life, problems with school, advice for graduate school. High school students often contact me and ask me about like how can they get into UCLA or into the field. And so that's the way I try to help people. Try to put my slides online, frankly, just so that more people can get access to my materials and teach themselves. I've been contacted by lots of people around the world, like people in Turkey, who said I learned computer science with your slides, and so that really helped me. So basically just trying to help as many people, try to help with my finance write-up. If you need some help figuring out how your finances when you graduate, I have a write-up on my website. Basically trying to put myself out there as much as I can.
Yeah, it's really great that, this is something I was actually going to bring up, but it's really great that you're open sourcing your content. I think that's like the next big thing in educational technology. So I'm part of this, part of ACM's Teach LA subcommittee, and we're really pushing to make sure all our slides are available because honestly, we can't, with all our physical power, we cannot reach every single student, but the fact that we can have our message out there and they have access to our materials is what really matters. If they have, if we can inspire some passion, some initiative, the materials are there for them to learn. And so that kind of ties into two pieces of advice. I'd like if you could provide our listeners. The first one is, what advice do you have for people who really want to get involved with CS, but just, they don't know where to start? Like there's just so many different things about CS that you could pursue, cybersecurity, back-end engineering. Where do you suggest people start?
So I've been tinkering around with Python recently, on my own, and it's very useful for machine learning, obviously. Python is a really easy language to learn. And so if somebody doesn't have a background in computer science, do the easiest thing you can do if you want to try to get into it. Learn something like Python, very easy to learn language. There's lots of tutorials online. They're generally well-written. There's lots of resources. And the most important thing to program is the thing that's enjoyable for you. So I would say if somebody thinks, oh, ultimately, you know, back-end engineering or AI is a really great area for me to get into, but you don't have enough background to do that, the last thing you want to do is jump into that with a lot of experience, because you'll just frustrate yourself. You'll feel like you can't do it. So instead, pick something easy. Learn how to build a simple program from scratch. Follow a tutorial, then follow another tutorial, then follow another tutorial, then try a simple project on your own. If you fail, try another project. There's some people feel like if you read a book, you've only succeeded if you finish the whole book from end to end. But other people think, well, if you read a book and you get a little something out of it, that's great. You don't have to finish a book to get value out of it, right? Same thing with a programming project. If you can program a project and get 20% of it done and learn something new, even if you don't finish it, there's value in that. So you don't feel bad if you don't finish things, and don't feel bad if you can't learn machine learning right from the beginning. Don't feel bad if you don't know what your ultimate area is going to be because you haven't figured it out yet. Instead, do what you enjoy. Do as many coding projects as you can. It's almost like learning to ride a bike. The more you do it, the better you're going to get at it. And don't get hung up over if you're not good at something. Just try to learn as much as you can and then move on to the next thing and try to learn as much as you can. That's what I did. I just did tons of projects unrelated to each other, some video games. I played with like converting DNA sequences into proteins, and so on, like as a side project just for fun. I knew nothing about it. I took a couple days. It was easy. Anybody could do that. You can just learn lots of stuff by trying lots of things, and eventually you'll find something that's exciting. So be open to new fields. Be open to that you might not know what you want to do yet, and you might actually find passion in an area that you don't know just by playing around and tinkering.
Yeah, that's really great. So like, your advice, starting from the easy stuff, just building up slowly, figuring out what you're really interested in. Now this is for like students who are trying that, like they open up that Python course on Code Academy and they start working on it. But then at the beginning, it's just so frustrating because they don't have any other prior experience with the mindset you need to program. And I think this is further aggravated, like this lack of confidence is further aggravated by the fact that there's a stigma attached to CS that only geniuses can pick up programming, or they can only pick up, AI, for example. What words of encouragement do you have to students like that? Can you like dispel any beliefs related to that?
the words of encouragement I would have for people would be that I was a B and C student when I started learning how to program, and a B student largely through junior high school, frankly. Like, I don't think I've got many A's at all, maybe PE. and I wasn't really great at math. I was okay at math. I didn't take advanced math classes. And what I found was the single most important thing to succeed at programming was not being a genius and not having formal training in calculus or anything else. It was just spending more time at programming and failing and trying again and failing and trying again and failing. And I didn't even have the internet back then, right? There's no internet. So just failing and trying again and then finally getting it. And so it might take people a little longer. Some people are naturally smarter. I was not one of those naturally smarter people. I just kept on failing and trying and failing and trying. And then eventually something clicked. And then something more clicked. And you can become smarter over time. I fundamentally believe this. The more you practice and the more of a model your brain builds of the world and of the problems you're trying to solve, the faster you're going to get. And so you might start out really slow and you might be really frustrated because it just takes you five times longer than anybody else. But if you stick with it, if you just don't give up, and you know what? Life is unfair. Sometimes you put in five times more time. And that's what I had to do. I spent 20 to 30 hours a week, every week, doing this stuff when I was a kid because I wasn't good at anything else and I wasn't smart. So my advice to people is if you're getting frustrated, try to find another resource. Try to find a friend who can help you. Try to just fail at it. Do it five different ways and see what works. Try to understand what's really going on. And it'll take a little longer and you'll get it. And then the next time it'll be a little easier. And the next time it'll be a little easier. And eventually it's going to be second nature.
Yeah, it's really great advice. And in this last 30 seconds that we have for this interview, if you could just very briefly say one or two sentences, words of encouragement that you have for youth from groups who may not see themselves represented in the field and think that they're not cut out for technology or CS or any other discipline, what would you have to say to them?
Well, first of all, let me just say you belong in AI. There's nothing that should prevent anybody from getting into this field. And my words of encouragement to you are just stick with it, be persistent. Failure is normal. Failure is what everybody has to go through when they first start. At least I had to go through endless failure. And you can get through it and you can do great things. The people I've seen most successful in life are not the most intelligent people. And I know some really, really smart people who have actually done very little with their lives. The people who have been most successful in their lives are the people who don't give up. So don't give up.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for interviewing with us today. It was really great to hear all your words of advice, to hear the ways in which, you know, you support your own students and what you've been doing since you graduated from UCLA. So thank you again.
Sure, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the first episode of You Belong in AI. This podcast was made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. My name is Arjun Subramanian, and today we interviewed Professor Carrie Notchenberg. The questions you heard in the podcast were made possible by our wonderful ACM AI Outreach officers, Maya, Kai, Jason, Matt, Aman, and Nisha. Furthermore, the podcast was edited by Jason Jewick. The music you heard in this podcast was Cheery Monday by Kevin McLeod. You can find more of his music at incompetech.filmmusic.io. This is a quick reminder to tune in again next time when we interview Luca Soldaini, who is an NLP engineer at Amazon Alexa.
You belong in AI.